Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. After a serious heart attack at the age of 41, John Kyle Ezell could have slowed down, really changed his life. He was an involved city planning professor at the Knowlton School of Architecture at Ohio State University. Instead of slowing down, though, he did the exact opposite. He speeded up his pace. He completely changed his diet and, well, I guess still really changed his life. All of that while participating in stem cell therapy research. In time, he's been cured, but what cured him, we still aren't sure about. Ezell has written a book for others struggling in the aftermath of a heart attack. It's called Becoming Bionic, The Little Book of Hope for Heart Patients. Coming up later, we'll hear from two people who are important to John in his recovery and have played important parts in his story. Right now, we welcome John Kyle Ezell. Welcome to the show, John.
Hi, Ann.
John Kyle Ezell, it's been almost exactly 2 years since you had that devastating heart attack that medical experts believe would change your life for the worse, for the rest of your life.
Right. 2 years this Friday. I can't believe it's been 2 years. 2 years ago, this Friday at 2 o'clock in the morning, I had this terrible stomach ache, and I thought that this must be the result of my Mexican dinner I had with this really hot sauce.
Yeah, the description of that in the book was kind of making me.
Yeah. Yep. So you never would guess. I love Mexican food in the first place. So eating all this delicious Mexican food with hot sauce on it, naturally you think that, hey, I have a stomach ache and it's keeping me up all night long. I'm not going to go to the hospital for this.
It happens. You know,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. About 5 in the morning, I was still up, and I got in the shower to try to take my mind off the stomach pain, and I got this flutter in my heart. It wasn't a pain, but it was a flutter, and it reminded me of my head felt like it was buzzing. And if you remember the Star Wars movie, the lightsaber, and and I thought, oh, I am in trouble. And my heart is fluttering.
That's when you
realize.
I got to
get out of here. So, yeah, and went to the hospital. And thank goodness I did. OSU Hospital. Let me tell you, Ann, Columbus, Ohio is the best place to have a heart attack. I'm so thankful for the doctors and the nurses who saved my life. I mean, it was an awesome experience.
But you were 41 years old. At first, they're like, are you sure it's not indigestion? I mean, even they weren't.
No, well, there's a test that it's for enzymes,
right,
to see if you actually are having a heart attack. And it never came back positive until the last hours later. And then they say, oh, my gosh, you're having a heart attack. And as soon as they realized that the enzyme test was there, they rushed me up and saved me.
My guest is John Kyle Ezell. He's written a book for others struggling in the aftermath of a heart attack. It's called Becoming Bionic, The Little Book of Hope for Heart Patients. Now, even before that night, you'd been having stomach problems that you just thought were indigestion, and that's why you went out and had that Mexican meal in the first place. You thought, I'm just going to, wipe it out with Mexican food.
I did. I had.
So this had been going on for quite a while, heart attack symptoms.
Yeah. And
you think?
I think so.
Yeah.
It was a sour. I told my
sour
friends
stomach.
And colleagues, I have a sour stomach, and my stomach feels sour. And that was all it was. It felt uncomfortable, but it wasn't pain. So, yeah, I have weird symptoms. I guess I'm a weirdo that way, because most people do have the chest pains, but there are all sorts of other symptoms I've learned that indicate heart attack.
You were 41 years old, and the prognosis, what did they tell you at first?
The doctor came in the next day and said, this was not just a little heart attack. You had a major heart attack. And let me tell you, when you think you're healthy and then someone tells you you're a heart patient, it's like being hit by a Mack truck, because the metaphor is perfect, because you're walking down the street and all of a sudden a truck hits you, and then you have to deal with this aftermath, the emotional part of getting used to the fact that I'm not healthy anymore. And I'm telling you, it's very hard to take. And I entered this terrible period of depression. I remember that, and it happened immediately. Exercise physiologists were walking me around Ross Heart Hospital afterward, And I remember I couldn't breathe. I was gasping for air, and my feet were swollen, and I was miserable. And I would go. They took me back to the room, and I was exhausted and couldn't believe that 50 feet almost put me put me down. Mm-hmm. And I was in bed just bawling, crying, hoping that a nurse wouldn't come in to see this happen. And that was the start of weeks and weeks of severe shock and mourning for my health. And there's nothing – now, people who've never had a health problem all of a sudden like this can't begin to understand how impactful it is and how you are mourning the death of your good health. So over those next few weeks, two, three weeks, when I was swollen and couldn't breathe and reading materials about heart failure while in bed and testing myself to see if I really did have heart failure and realizing that I can't breathe with one pillow and I'm gasping and it's an absolutely miserable, horrifying experience. And another, I remember one thing that a vivid memory of mine was when I went back to work. I was walking down the sidewalk on Woodruff Avenue, and I thought I was walking at a normal pace, and all of these students were passing me like they were. It felt like they were running in fast motion, and it was like I was in the Twilight Zone because they were, gorgeous, robust, healthy kids, and I was this old 100-year-old man.
You spent some time talking about how embarrassed you were and that you didn't want your students to know what had happened and you didn't want anybody to really know what had happened. You tried to fake it, not very well. I read like it didn't go very well. But what about that embarrassment? Why were you embarrassed?
Because I don't want people to look at me differently. I don't want people to say, oh, you poor guy with a heart attack. Oh, don't upset him or don't make him stressed out. I don't want to be treated differently. So I especially didn't want my students to look at me any differently because I love teaching and that's my passion. And just the idea of that made me do anything in my – let me just give you a story, Ann, a short story. I was in one of the halls of a building on campus, and I always arrive 30 minutes early to school, and one of my students and I seem to get there at the same time, and we walk up four flights of stairs together, and that was just what we did, and just because we were there at the same time, and mm-hmm. we wanted to walk up the stairs. Well, the first day I returned to that building, there she was, and I was standing near the elevator, and she came up to me, and I'm holding on to the wall. I'm holding on to the wall and know that at any minute I may not be able to breathe. I might fall down. And she said, why aren't you going up the stairs with me? Come on, let's go up the stairs. Don't take the elevator. I didn't have enough breath to even respond to her. And I remember the elevator door opening, and I walked in the elevator door, and I turned around, and she was staring at me. And then the door closes in her face, and I reach over to the railing, just gasping, and hoping that she's not there when the door
opens. I'm trying to think how you even got. I mean, just getting in the building and getting into an elevator and taking an elevator up to the next whatever floor you were headed to was one thing, but actually standing in front of a classroom of energetic, inquisitive, I mean, who are looking forward to their energetic, inquisitive, animated teacher that's going to be there. And how did you even get through those classes?
I don't know. I don't know. And thinking back to that, it makes me so sad because I know that there's so many thousands, millions of people who feel like that. And they're scared to move. I mean, I thought to myself, if I make too big of a move, I'm going to die. And being scared to move like as a normal person would move around, that's devastating, totally devastating.
What changed? What happened?
I was in bed one night and gasping for breath, and I looked up at the TV, and it was about a show about Holocaust survivors, And they were talking about how they had to have hope in order to get through the situation that they were in, and talking about literally smelling maybe their sisters. I mean, it was so devastating to watch this. And I thought to myself, how in the world am I got to get my act together. I don't have any problems. I've got to do something about this. I got to get a better attitude about my health. I've got to take charge of myself. And I decided late one night after watching that horrifying documentary that I stood up and went to the bathroom and pulled myself up and looked myself in the mirror and told myself, you are an athlete. And I thought that because the opposite person of who I was at that moment is an athlete, is a runner. And I looked at myself again and said, you are a runner and you are going to run marathons. And that day changed everything because I told myself that this is what I'm going to be. I'm not going to be someone who's walking around feeling sorry for myself, holding my chest and waiting to die. I'm going to get up and make something awesome happen for myself.
A little bit of something had to do with the fact that you were invited to participate in a clinical trial because of your illness. What was it about that idea? And we're going to get to the whole clinical trial and what happened with that in a little while. But what about being invited to participate in something? At first, you were, you know, no way, you know, and then you changed your mind. And what about that had the impact that it did?
It's a big part of the story because the day after my heart attack, when I was furious, all the emotions that you feel when you're sick, a lot of people don't realize this, that you go through a roller coaster. And that day I was PO'd. I would have spit in God's face.
The whole grieving process is just mentioned earlier, right?
Horrifying. So one day a nurse knocked on my door and said, hi, my name's Laura. And I'd like to offer you a chance to be in a clinical trial. And she was so nice. And I basically told her, you know, get the hell out of my room. I don't want to be a part of this. And we laugh about it today because it was so dramatic. I don't want you in here. I didn't want anybody in there, not just Laura, but people who came in and seemed to be nice. I didn't have time to help somebody else in the clinical trial. I'm trying to help myself. So get lost. And she basically looked at me and smiled and said, well, my clinical trial is about stem cells. And I remember I was laying down on the bed and I pushed the button and I kind of raised up and looked over at her and said, talk to me. So I was admitted into a stem cell trial to see if stem cells, adult stem cells, not embryonic stem cells, but adult stem cells would be able to heal my heart and take care of the damage and make my heart function better. And I was put through an enormous battery of tests in order to get into the trial. Mm-hmm. And I made it there. And when I told you about the story when I was in the bed and decided to make that decision, the decision about I'm going to be an athlete. Mm-hmm. From the time I was in the hospital to the time I made that decision, I relied on the fact that I might have stem cells. I have hope. Because I have stem cells, they're going to fix my heart. But then as I was miserable and not getting better and still swollen in my feet and faking it and collapsing at home, I realized that I probably don't have them and I got to figure something out. And to this day, I don't know if I have them or not.
When we come back, we're going to talk about that research with Laura Yamakowski. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, 39 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:20 this morning. Sunshine today and a high of 42, clear skies tonight, a low of 23 degrees. And some sunshine for Saturday, a nice weekend, a high of 51. More sunshine on Sunday and a high of 62.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Columbus Foundation, celebrating our nationally ranked businesses and nonprofit leaders, making our community stronger. With donors and funds in 33 Ohio counties, the Columbus Foundation, where your philanthropy and your community come together.
The WOSU Member Card Benefit of the Month for March is Chamber Music Columbus. Enjoy 2-for-1 admission to the New York Woodwind Quintet on March 24th. Become a basic $60 member and get your member card by going to WOSU.org right now. And All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
Two years ago at the age of 41, John Kyle Ezell suffered what was to be a life-changing heart attack. Things did change, but for the better. John has written a new book on the topic for others who face life after a heart attack. Part of the story is that he was chosen to participate in a stem cell clinical trial, which is how he met one of the two angels in his story. Joining us now to talk about that is Laura Yamakowski, a heart failure program research manager and coordinator at the Ohio State University Medical Center. Welcome to the show, Laura.
Hi, Ann. Thanks so much for having me.
That's a long title for what?
Well, basically, I'm a nurse. I've been a cardiology nurse for 11 years, and we have a very large heart and vascular research organization here at OSU. And one of the things that we do is run clinical trials. And through the outpatient clinics, through the inpatient side of things, and cardiology, we do everything from device trials to drug trials, and like I said, inpatient, outpatient. We feel clinical trials here at OSU makes us really kind of special because we have additional therapies that we think might be beneficial to patients. So in addition to their normal standard of care treatment, we're working closely with the physicians and other folks within the medical center to develop new therapies.
And you're the person that walks through the door the first time and meets the patient for the first time and asks them or invites them to join the trial?
Sometimes it's me, sometimes it's the physicians, sometimes it's whoever's the front line of contact. So a lot of times on the inpatient side, the physicians, because they're seeing the patients first, will identify the patients and then give us a call and say, hey, this patient came through, we'd like you to go talk to them. And a lot of times they're talking to the patients first, letting them know that we're going to be coming by. We really work together as a big team. Just because we're a big institution.
Was John Kyle's reaction to your invitation, his initial reaction, pretty typical?
I would say he did catch me a little bit off guard. I will never forget knocking on his door. I always introduce myself, tell them what I'm there for, who I work with, because the patients aren't kind of wondering, great, here comes another white coat through the door now, what do they want? You want to make the patients feel comfortable. And I have to say it's been a long time since I've had somebody kind of look at me like that, like take a flying leap. And
Is he still atypical in terms of his age and that sort of thing? Is it pretty unusual to be talking to someone so young who's had a heart attack?
Yes and no. At OSU here, we have patients really of all ages that come through the door. Typically, they are a little bit older. A lot of patients coming back with reoccurring heart attacks. This particular clinical trial happened to be looking at patients that came in with their first heart attack. So that makes a big difference in terms of recruitment because these patients, most of them were a little bit younger.
Apparently healthier, right.
And when you do clinical trials, you have to follow the protocols very closely. And so a lot of protocols have very strict inclusion-exclusion criteria. John alluded to earlier, he went through a series of tests after we had talked about the trial and he had a lot of time to think about it and decide if this was something that he wanted to do. As I always like to say, we never twist patients' arms to do anything. We present them with the opportunity, make sure that they have all their questions answered. Once they've consented to participating, then we kind of start the official screening process in terms of labs and all that stuff.
At that point, it's possible that something could have disqualified him.
Oh, absolutely.
And that has to be a hard thing to tell somebody once they've made that leap with you to, you know, to do the trial.
Yes, absolutely. And we do see that. And it is unfortunate, but that's kind of the nature of the beast, so to speak. And we make sure that patients are aware of that up front, that there isn't potential that you may not qualify. You don't always know, you know, what you're going to come across. And that's a leap of faith that the patients take, which we are always so appreciative that the patients are, they're volunteering their time. Nobody has to do this. So they're doing this hopefully to benefit themselves. We don't always know that the clinical trial is going to be beneficial. We hope that it is. We think it is. We don't take on anything that we don't think would be potentially beneficial. But most clinical trials, it's like flipping a coin, you know, whether you get, if it's a drug trial, typically it's, you know, you either get the drug or you don't get the drug.
A couple questions. This is with adult stem cells. So this would this have fallen into the category that was banned during the Bush administration as far as using them for study? Do you know?
I think this would not have fallen into that
adult.
Because they were adult.
Right.
Yeah, this particular study was adult stem
cells.
And
then also it's a double blind study. What
Correct.
Does that mean?
Double blind means we don't know what the patient gets.
You don't even know.
I don't even know. Mm-hmm. The physicians don't know. And then the other blinded part of that is the patients don't know. So all the patients are treated the same. The only person that knows is the pharmacist because they have to prepare the infusion. So there's no way around that. They have to be
blinded. Someone's got to get the stuff into the...
Correct. Right. So they would deliver the product. You know, deliver the product to us.
So, one of the questions John Kyle Ezell, he is doing great physically, but will we ever know?
The hope is yes. A lot of the clinical trials, depend on the sponsor. So, what will happen is a lot of times after the databases are locked, they will unblind us, meaning they will provide us with a list of patients that got the product and then the folks that were on placebo. We're not guaranteed that. It is up to the individual sponsors or the companies.
Right now, I'm talking with Laura Yamakowski and also John Kyle Ezell. John's written a book. It's called Becoming Bionic, The Little Book of Hope for Heart Patients. John, you don't know, you may never know. Ultimately, how does that feel?
Well, I told Laura when we first got started, well, I didn't tell her. I asked her to please tell me. Of course, I didn't understand the double-blind study as much as I probably should because I wanted to know so much that I had the stem cells. I needed to know that because it was going to save me. In order to get in the stem cell trial, you had to have an ejection fraction less than 45.
That's technical.
Yes. Well, mine was 35, so I was way down there. So
okay.
I had this severe heart attack. These stem cells were gonna get me back up to 70. That's how I was thinking. But now, I don't really want the stem cells. My heart is healed. I'm better.
But you're still getting them, right?
Well, it was a one-time injection.
It was a one-time
infusion when the patients were here in the hospital with us. So, like I said, it was like flipping a coin, whether they got the stem cells or not. They go through the battery of tests. We come in and tell the patients if they qualify or not. And then once, you know, we find out that they qualified, things kind of happen while they're here. And then...
Well, let me ask you... Is what Kyle did subsequently, the way he got in shape for marathons, is that unusual? And how does that play into the protocol for the study?
Well, what he did really is outside of the protocol. I mean, the protocol didn't necessarily require that patients go and run marathons. But, you know, it's really interesting. The way most protocols work is – you know, you bring the patients back at specific intervals and you follow the protocol in terms of whatever lab work and testing needs to be done, and you really just track them. This particular study is a two-year follow-up. We just did his two-year visit, I believe, last week. And, you know, so technically he's actually done with the study. Now, of course, I know him so well, we'll be still following him very closely in clinic. But, you know, just to kind of see, you know, what happens. So we really just track the patients and you report all the data and go from there.
Richard in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you again. You got a wonderful show, Ann.
Thank you, Richard.
I learned a lot about the history and the politics of Harrison and all, and it's wonderful. Also, here's what my question is.
Okay.
What does the medical staff say, or have they said, what actually caused John's heart attack?
Do they, John, you're shaking your head.
Well, what caused my heart attack? I really don't know. I thought I was healthy. My dad had a heart attack when he was in his mid-50s. So I knew it was coming someday. I just didn't know it was going to come so early.
Were there any, clogged arteries, that kind of a thing? I mean,
yeah, I have 30% clogged and a 40. I have some clogged arteries, kind of clogged arteries, I suppose. Not enough to have bypass surgery,
mm-hmm.
but I do have heart disease. So heart disease causes a heart attack, and I've learned that even if you have a little bit of plaque in your arteries, that plaque can burst. And also, I learned that 50% or some high percentage of the population have heart disease and don't know it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't like to look back and say, well, what happened to me? Because it really is not productive. I just have to take where I am right now and then just make myself better and hope that I prevent the next one from happening somehow.
Thanks, Richard, for your call.
Well, thank you very much.
Take care. My guests, Laura Yamakowski, Heart Failure Program Research Manager and Coordinator at the Ohio State University Medical Center, and also John Kyle Ezell, author of a new book for heart attack survivors. It's called Becoming Bionic, The Little Book of Hope for Heart Patients. Hal in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Hal.
Hi, thank you. My question is for both of them. I would like to know if either of them are either aware of or participate in the Mended Hearts group that meets there at the university, at the hospital.
John Kyle?
I just became aware of them a month ago, and yes, sir, I'm going to participate in that. Can't wait to do it because people who are in that hospital are scared, and I know how they feel. And if I had someone like me and the Mended Hearts people talk to me, I would probably be a lot less angry and upset because I know that you can get better.
Hal, are you a participant?
Yes, actually, I was among the founding members of that group. It recently, within the last two or three years, it started there at the university and here in Columbus. I'm wondering about the clinical trial person. Are they networking with the Mended Hearts group?
Laura Yamakowski?
We haven't done a whole lot specifically with that group. We work very closely with the cardiac rehab folks up on the floor, and as well as the staff nurses and the rest of the medical staff in terms of, you know, the physicians, the fellows, the residents, and all that. That, you know, is something that probably would be good for us to be incorporated with or, you know, spend some time with. I know when we talk to patients about clinical trials, it's not always just about the clinical trials, because those of us that run the clinical trials have a lot of medical background, and we, you know, myself, I'm also an exercise physiologist in addition to a nurse, so we end up kind of doing a lot of education with the patients in terms of, you know, kind of all areas of their disease or whatever they're, you know, admitted for cardiac-wise.
Thanks, Hal.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Appreciate that. Just last November, The Lancet reported a new study that says heart damage may be reversible with stem cell therapy without dangerous side effects. The study was performed at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles using cardiac stem cells extracted from the patient's heart rather than stem cells from adult bone marrow. But the study needs to be duplicated in larger studies. So as far as that goes, what do we know? Because somebody got a placebo. What do we know about the placebo effect and to what extent that might affect you, John Kyle or Laura?
Well, we've seen in clinical trials overall across the board, and a lot of the physicians that do clinical trials, they'll tell you, and, well, we can tell you too, just I've been working in clinical trials now for almost 12 years, and there is a big placebo effect. A lot of patients have the perception that they are getting closer follow-up or quote-unquote better care. I don't know that. I mean, it's definitely closer because most of the protocols require close follow-up. We usually have additional testing in addition to what would be done in clinic. Plus, we give patients our direct phone numbers, and I think just that in itself makes a big difference. Not that the clinic is not personable. We have a fabulous clinic in the Ross. It's just that they're very busy and they're in clinic, so they're not sitting at their phone. And we're usually in our offices. We have our pagers on, so they patients can get a hold of us. And I think sometimes that's just they feel like it's a little more personable, so to speak. And you know, we've had a lot of patients tell us when they're done with clinical trials, you know, we'll sometimes do surveys before we tell them if they got the drug or if they were on placebo. What do they think? You know, it's always very interesting, the patient's perceptions. And there are a lot of patients that think that they get the drug and they've gotten placebo.
So how long is it when will John Kyle know whether or not he received the stem cells?
Well, we're thinking for this particular trial, it's a two-year follow-up trial. So the companies, usually when the last person across the country was enrolled, which I don't remember when that was.
And when they hit their two-year mark.
Hit their two-year mark, sometimes the company's halfway mark, sometimes. Probably for this trial, we're hoping within a year.
And how many people are involved in it?
At OSU, we enrolled, I believe, 18 patients.
And this is going on around the country?
It's going on around the country. And if I remember right, I think it was around 250 patients enrolled across the country. We were, I think, one of the top enrolling sites in the country.
When we return, we're going to talk to the trainer, exercise specialist, who helped John Kyle Ezell reach his goal of running a marathon within less than 2 years, well, less than 2 years, of a very major heart attack. And we'll talk more about his book. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Car doing strange things?
It does what I call the Elvis idle.
A shake, rattle, and roll?
It goes like this. It goes.
I don't shake up. The Elvis idle. I love it.
Every problem may not have a solution,
but it's always worth a couple of laughs. Join us this week for Car Talk.
Car Talk tomorrow at noon on 89.7 NPR News. And remember, you can get access to our station anytime online at WOSU.org. Hear local and national news all day, every day from the convenience of your computer or mobile device. Listen to 89.7 NPR News online anytime at WOSU.org. Stay right here in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. All Sides Weekend begins with host Christopher Purdy and a look at what books some local critics are recommending. Join us for All Sides Weekend Books. That's from 11 till noon on 89.7 NPR News. 41 degrees with partly sunny skies. Expect sunshine today and a high near 45. Clear skies tonight, a little chilly, a low of 23 degrees. Sunshine for Saturday, a high of 51. Clear skies Saturday night, a low of 34 degrees. A nice day on Sunday, sunshine and a high of 62. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
2 years ago, at the age of 41, John Kyle Ezell suffered what was considered a life-changing heart attack. Things did change, but for the better. John has written a new book on the topic for others who face life after a heart attack. He's still with us, along with Laura Yamakowski, a heart failure program research manager and coordinator at the Ohio State University Medical Center. Joining us now is Lori Yale. Lori is an exercise physiologist at OSU, where she has worked almost 9 years in cardiac rehabilitation. She is an American College of Sports Medicine certified clinical exercise specialist and soon will be an ASCM certified as a wellness coach. Welcome to the show, Lori.
Thanks, Ann. Thanks for having me.
We got an email from Tim. He wondered, how healthy was John at 41? Could he describe his fitness level pre-heart sick? So, John, why don't you do that, and then we can take us through that process to where you met Lori and what you achieved.
I thought I was healthy, and I went to the gym, not like I do today, but I just thought I was healthy. So I wasn't. I didn't think I was the typical heart attack candidate, and I was shocked when I had the heart attack. So that's the best I can answer.
So how did he show up on your table, Lori Yale?
When John came in to cardiac rehab, the first thing that we do is we do a VO2 max stress test. And I've been doing these, you know, for a long time, even before I worked at Ohio State. I worked in another cardiac rehab facility where we did stress testing. So to me, it's a routine thing. But as Laura had mentioned, I will never forget John when he stepped in there, because he had the energy. I could see potential. I could identify with him, and just that drive that he had to just get better. And I could tell he was an athlete just from his demeanor. And I was so excited when he chose the morning class, which is the class that I work with, because I really wanted to work with him, because I could just see it, that he was really, really excited. To me, he looked like a runner. I mean, he has a runner's body. I was just like, this guy looks like he could run a marathon right now. Although I don't think he saw that in himself, I saw that. So I was really excited to have him. I did the stress test. He did excellent. So he already had a great base.
And this was after the heart attack.
This was after the heart attack.
How soon afterward?
I'm not exactly
sure. 6 weeks.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, we typically see people even sooner after heart attack. We'll do a stress test maybe 2 weeks after.
Mm-hmm. But in the book, when you're describing when you first started working out, it was a real struggle.
Oh,
but the stress test doesn't necessarily say he's going to struggle with this. It just says he's able to struggle with it.
Right, right. Typically when we do a stress test, a lot of our cardiac rehab patients will rank in the low category. He was already coming in a lot higher than them, and on our chart, it was probably in the good. But when we did his exit test after 36 visits, after 3 months, he was in the above average, like excellent category.
Why did it happen that somebody told him after his heart attack that this was going to change his life and that he was going to have heart problems probably or possibly for the rest of his life? Why does that happen?
I think the doctors might have, you know, wanted to be realistic as far as how much damage had occurred to the heart muscle itself. But you can improve your ejection fraction, like John had alluded to earlier. A low ejection fraction is around 30, and normal is 60% or so. And you can improve that through exercise. So, you know, a lot of times, you know, you have to be upfront because people aren't going to change. And there's modifiable risk factors and non-modifiable. Non-modifiable being, you know, family history, like his dad had a heart attack under the age of 55. That puts you at a high risk. If it's a female, it's under 65. So if you had a mother, aunt, someone like a close relative that had even family history, that's you know, non-modifiable. But modifiable, like our diet and exercising and not smoking and these type of environmental things that we can control, you know, that's what we really have to get our patients to do, and we can't do that for them. So,
John Kyle?
Lori told me that I should get prepared to run a 5K, because she was raising money for Pelotonia, and she was holding a 5K. So the first week or two, she said, your goal is to run a 5K.
And because she needed your money.
Yes. And I told her, I'm going to run a half marathon. I was thinking marathon, but I didn't want to scare her. Because it's scary enough for a heart patient to say that he wants to run a half marathon.
Right.
She was awesome. She whipped me into shape. And I'll never forget it. In the cardiac rehab room, and I was the only one running. I'm running and running and running and running. And by the end of the time there, which was, how long was that, 3 months?
3 months, 36 visits, three times a week we meet, Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday.
I was running 7 miles on the treadmill. And it's boring. The treadmill is so boring.
Yeah, I've done
but
it.
Yes. And I'm visioning me running the marathon. I'm running this marathon. I'm focused on that.
You did something with your hands
yes.
to relate to your heart.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe that to us?
Yes. I have a heart puppet, and I named him Frank. And Frank, if you can imagine, pulling your fingers out all the way and then pumping it back in and making a heart-shaped fist and doing it over and over, like just pumping your heart. That was my artificial heart to help my heart get back into shape. So Lori knew I was visualizing this marathon. I'm not sure if you guys saw me doing this, but I was hiding it. I was a little embarrassed by it. I know one staff member did, caught me doing it. But I would do this under the table. I would
wherever you happen to be,
anywhere,
right.
Just pumping my heart. I'm getting my heart.
Why do you think that helps?
I think, well, I don't know. I mean,
visualization. You can create a visual. Like, if the more you can visualize something as an athlete, whether it's a movement or a picture, it's going to become more real.
You'll get there. You'll achieve it. Mm-hmm. Now, you started out running for 10 minutes. Less.
I started out running for 30 seconds.
Right. We usually have patients start off with intervals. We'll have them walk on an incline. And then if I see, if their exercise prescription, we have to follow, an exercise program based off of their stress test. But there are, if we get it approved through their cardiologist, that they can increase their target heart rate range, which John, was strong enough and he could do that. But yeah, we'll have them run at intervals. So walk on an incline, then drop the hill down, start running, and then we'll just keep building them up over the weeks.
Were you impatient?
Yeah. It was so frustrating because the first day I was there, if you can remember this,
yeah,
you put me on the bicycle and yeah. I could barely for mm-hmm. 5 minutes on
yeah.
the on easy.
I do
was
remember.
I was sweating and
right.
And I you had to sit me down and
yeah.
Were you ever scared though? Because a lot of people after they've had a heart attack are scared. They're afraid to exercise because they don't want to overexert their heart.
That is why I wrote this book, because you're already in trouble if you're scared to live your life. And I've had that fear of movement and fear of exercise, and I know so many heart patients do. And my advice, looking at this from a heart patient and not from a medical professional, is that you have to be outlandish. For instance, I'm going to run a marathon. That is my goal. My goal is not I am going to make it to the bathroom. Because if I make it halfway to my marathon, I'm going to run a half marathon. But if I make it halfway to the bathroom, I'm not even going to be able to use it. So that is being outlandish and setting really, really high goals for yourself is very important. And that is what I want people to know, that you can get better and you can even be better than you were before a heart attack.
Why do you call it becoming bionic?
Because I'm old enough to remember.
You don't look like Steve Spencer.
I'm old enough to remember Lee Majors on
Lee Majors.
The $6 Million Man.
Right.
And I remember, if I remember correctly, the opening segment or the opening to that was him running really fast and running. You could see him running in fast motion. And that's how I picture myself. I'm superhuman. I'm going to be able to run these long distances. And that's part of the becoming outlandish, too, is to get your mindset in that big goal mindset.
My guest is John Kyle Ezell. We're talking about his new book. It's called Becoming Bionic, The Little Book of Hope for Heart Patients. Also with us, Lori Yamakowski, the Ohio State University Medical Center, and Lori Yale. She's an exercise specialist, the Center for Wellness Prevention at Ohio State University. You call Lori Yale and Laura Yamakowski your angels, your two angels. Why?
If I hadn't had met these two, I would not be in the shape I am now. The people that come into your life when you really need them, you cling to, and these two are the most positive people that I could have ever hoped to meet in that time. So that's why I call them angels, because they are angels of mine. They took care of me.
Lori, are most of the people that you work with, are they heart patients?
Yes. Yeah. Stents, heart attacks, bypasses, valve repairs, congestive heart failure.
And how does John Kyle stand out from the pack?
Well, like he's mentioned, younger. We do have younger patients that have heart attacks and heart problems and congenital heart disease. So we do have younger. But the fact that he was so willing to dream big is what I call it. And just take those steps and, like, potential. I mean, it's just how I think, too. Like, we think alike a lot. So, and I've run marathons, too. So I know that when you're at mile 17, 18, and your quads are cramping up and, like, how am I going to make it to 26? You just have to push through. So it's really rewarding on our end as medical professionals to see someone who really wants to change. And is willing to put in the work to do it. So that's how he stands out. Very different.
You became a vegan. You changed your every. I mean, the descriptions of how you used to eat.
Oh, I loved.
That was amazing. How
red
you used
steaks.
To eat.
Oh yes, bloody red steaks and my favorite was the low carb diet where I had this mound of spinach and two packs of sausage.
Right.
So I ate very
poorly.
You thought
you were doing good back then, yeah.
Well, that sort of low-carb diet makes you look good, but apparently is not good for you otherwise, as I learned the hard way. But, yeah, I am now a vegan with a capital V. You know what? Sometimes, Ann, I'll tell you that I'll go to the hot bar when I do grocery shopping, and I put my nose down and just smell the chicken fingers, the greasy, greasy chicken fingers. Oh, and I still do that today.
You
it's
can
a
smell
struggle.
It's non-caloric and.
Well, yeah, it's true, but I still struggle.
Yeah,
I love meat and I love grease. Mm.
You have a lot of willpower. Anyone who does a marathon has a lot of willpower and has a lot of fortitude. How do you encourage others without giving someone unrealistic expectations, John Kyle Ezell?
There are no unrealistic expectations, because if you don't have high hope for your health, you don't have anything. So I don't believe in unrealistic expectations, because had I had unrealistic expectations, I wouldn't have gotten to this shape. And having said that, I have a new important mission in my life, and that's to become Cardio Richard Simmons. I want to go around to hospitals. I want to go invite people to run with me in the marathons after you've had a heart attack. I believe in it so much that I want people to know that I'm available for them on my website, and I do video blogs when I run. I hold the video camera up and talk to the video camera. And you know what? Had I seen that when I was in that shape, I would have been so happy to know that I existed. And I know this sounds a little pompous, I suppose, but I needed me back then very much. I needed to know that I can run a marathon. I don't have to be so afraid. And I'm still afraid, but I don't let that get in my way. So I think that people who are listening to this, and everybody out there knows that you know someone who has heart disease or has had a heart attack, that it doesn't have to be downward spiral. You can actually make yourself go the other way. And so I don't believe in false hope.
Lori Yale, do you agree that people could use a lot more of John Kyle Ezell's out there as role models?
Oh, definitely. I think, just as you said, you're in that hospital, you're in that room, you're looking around at people on oxygen, people hooked up to IVs. I can only imagine the thoughts in your head and just, you know, thinking, wow, just yesterday I was, you know, climbing up four flights of stairs, teaching classes, and then here I am in a hospital bed with IVs and hooked up. So a visualization again, like if he could have seen a video of a guy his age running marathons, if that was out there and available to him, he might not, it might have helped him kind of overcome some of those boundaries that seem to be in his way. But I mean, I think it's awesome that he's out there promoting this for people.
And the damage is gone.
My heart is healed. My heart is healed. Yes.
Completely.
As far as I know, yes. That's what I was told.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
What's your website?
Becomingbionic.com.
Becomingbionic.com. We'll post that on our website as well, along with a link to Becoming Bionic, the little book of hope for heart patients. John, Kyle, Ezell, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Ann.
Appreciate it. Laura Yamakowski at Ohio State University Medical Center. Thanks for joining us, Laura.
Thanks so much, Ann.
And Lori Yale, exercise specialist at the Center for Wellness Prevention at Ohio State University. Thanks, Lori.
Thanks, Ann. And thank you, John, for writing this book.
You're welcome.
Thanks, John.
And thanks, everybody, for listening. I want to thank the staff at All Sides as well. Producer Linda Taylor, associate producer Amy Jurovich, All Sides intern Corinne Gleckler, All Sides production assistant Ayan Sheik, high school student intern Ben Faith. Also, Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music, WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrola, and Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Thanks for all your help, and thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.